On the bus. Woo-hoo-hoo. On the bus stop. Dun, 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 dun.
Huzzah! Welcome to the show.
We are in a frenzy over here. It's election day. We got a great podcast guest. Election Facebook feeds are almost out of the way. I'm going to take a photo.
I got a question for you. Why are you taking a photo of us right here in the middle of starting our podcast episode?
That's because I'm using a gopher case, and I'm able to talk with you, take a picture, pick my nose, make some MCT coffee, and still be able to get this photo out through the case without even using my phone at all.
Well, what the hell is a gopher case?
Normally, I stick to the rules when questions are asked. Rule 63, if you have to ask, you can't afford it. But because it's you, Daniel, I'm going to make an exception. Gopher stick is an accessory included Bluetooth-enabled selfie stick and lanyard keychain, which can be clipped to the back of your phone so you can use the accessory whenever you want. Most accessory phone cases force you to take on extra weight or size in order to have the functionality of accessory. Oh, but not the gopher case. Clip it when you want and out when you don't. Visit the website gophercase.com and use the code ONTHEBUS. That's three words. O-N space T-H-E space B-U-S to get 10% off any and all cases and accessories. Listen, folks, it's about optimization. It's about making your life easier and optimal, right? The selfie stick's a great invention. It's awesome we're able to take these photos and we're able to share them. But with this stick, you're able to share them much faster and you're able to get to that moment you want to capture even quicker. You're not pulling your stick out, taking your phone, pulling apart the frame, and shoving your phone in. There goes that moment. The moment it's only, what, a half second? We're a half second behind every moment. You better capture it. You better catch it. This gopher stick's going to help you do that. This podcast is also brought to you by Organifi Green Juice Powder. Being the nomadic bus driver, I travel. I get around. One thing that hasn't become travel friendly is a juicer. I can't do it, Daniel. I don't have anything. I can't carry a juicer around.
Who could lug all that equipment onto the bus?
It's an optimal bus. We're looking for optimal performance, optimal output. This green juice powder comes with wheatgrass, moringa, spirulina, chlorella, matcha, and a blend of herbs such as coconut, ashwagandha, turmeric, and beetroot. It's not your normal vegetable or a fruit powder that come with like 10 or 12 different fruits. You can still find those when on the road. These are the essential ones you're going to need to help you prevent illness, sickness, and injury while you're traveling. You're mixing and blending with people from all over the world with different diseases, with different backgrounds. You're going to get sick. Your germs and their germs are going to mesh.
Juicing without doing the juicing.
I'm telling you, this is a ticket.
Game changer.
So head over to OrganifiShop.com. That's OrganifiShop.com. Use promo code BUSDRIVER, and not only will you find the Organifi Green Juice Powder, but you'll also find several other probiotic supplements, as well as turmeric supplements. This last advertisement goes out to all those Trump supporters, Hillary supporters, Bag of Tarantula supporter, Bag of Scorpion supporters, and all you green and libs out there. Do you want to leave your house anymore? The possibility you might interact with other people who just don't believe in the same thing as you do. Then again, if you go on the internet, you're still going to find all those people. You're going to interact with them. But now you have a choice to do that. You don't have to go out and see some of these people who you might despise. A friend of mine recently called Trump supporters domestic terrorists. Anybody who could support them is a domestic terrorist. Do you want to go to a marketplace with those people? Or just jump through our portal at Amazon.com and be able to shop with the ease and comfort and isolation of not having to deal with those people you despise and hate the most. Those Bag of Scorpions people are real assholes, quoted by Bag of Tarantula supporter. Then you have the Green Party. They really hate those libs. Big, big government, no small government. So please, head over to our portal at onthebus.com. Click on the Amazon portal and do all your shopping there. So, start stocking up on the supplies if you think the apocalypse is near. Now on to today's guest, Joe Soberswag. Joe He's the governor of music festivals. He runs the show. He builds it, not a wall, but he puts them together, and he puts together these amazing, amazing, amazing extravaganzas, or just celebrations of being humans, as I like to call them. He's worked, currently works at Live Nation as a marketing manager. He's worked for Tomorrowland and SFX, helping them put together and launch Tomorrow World in America. Being so close with Joe, I've seen his growth. I've seen his movement throughout the electronic music industry, from us attending these raves, festivals, being fans, being snobs, talking about how we hated this guy, we're never going to go see this person, sticking to only one genre, to really exploring and expanding, yeah, the music we like, and for Joe, finding his passion. This is what this episode really, really tackles, highlighting how someone found his passion where he never would have possibly found it, never thought he would find it. So without further ado, let me get this bus in motion. Cue the music!
Okay.
One of the first questions people usually ask you is, like, what do you do? And I'm sure it's such a hard question or picture to paint when someone comes to you and said, Joe, what's going on? So what do you do for a living? You know, what is your description? How do you tell people, this is what I do, I'm Joe Silverswine?
Well, I mean, in the professional world, I don't wear a ton of hats. Currently, I am the director of business development for electronic music at Live Nation. Live Nation is the largest concert promoter or largest music company in the world, a publicly traded company. But within that, my sole focus is really just on electronic music, which is really made up of the Insomniac family of brands and also Hard Presents, two of the biggest dance music brands in the world located here in Southern California. And my role there is to really attract and develop relationships with brand sponsors to create more revenue and also find ways to enhance the fan experience. So that's pretty much what I do on a day-to-day basis, both on the weekend and during the week as well.
Awesome. And you recently just moved out to California, correct?
Yeah, I've been out here for about 6 months. I was a big, fat New Yorker my whole life up until that point, and moved out here to Venice Beach, West LA, and so far I'm really, really loving it. It's been a great, big life change for me, but it's been a lot of fun so far.
Awesome. And you were just in South Florida. I know you had EDC Orlando. How was that? How did that go?
It was good. I got back yesterday. I think my voice is still a little bit raspy. It was a long weekend. You know, my current role, I'm not as, let's say, occupied or as involved in the production of the festival. So, you know, I was really there to, you know, maintain and develop client relationships with some of our biggest sponsors there at the festival, which include, you know, a lot of different alcohol and cigarette brands primarily, you know, brands that are kind of looking to be in that millennial party or experiential space. So it was a great festival. I believe it was in its fourth or fifth year now, held at Tinker Field in Orlando, attracted well over 30,000 people a day. And it's a great kind of intimate EDC experience compared to the Las Vegas one. I think it's a great kind of gateway EDC in that respect for kids that maybe can't afford or, you know, don't have the opportunity to make it all the way out to Vegas. And I had a great time.
You know, it's the regional festival of the NCAA tournaments, national championship would be EDC Las Vegas. It's like not even people can make it to that national championship game. So they put those small little bracket tournaments all around the country. And okay, here you go. You get a small regional EDC in case you can't afford it.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think that those events have purpose for everybody. You know, and, you know, just because EDC Vegas is the biggest festival in the country certainly doesn't mean it's the best one, because everybody has their own take on kind of what makes a great festival experience.
Amen. I can definitely agree to that. I just went to Suwannee Halloween not too long ago, and man, just a very, very different layout, very different cross genre of music going on at the festival, and ended up being one of my favorite festivals I've ever been to. And I mean, I've been there, been to them all over the world. Primarily electronic music, I'll say. And this one, it rocked my world. Had a blast.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I think in American festival culture, I often hear fans say, you know, the bigger the better, and they want to get to the biggest festivals, or whether that be Coachella or, you know, EDC, of course. And I think that's, you know, the very much the American mentality, and bigger is not always better, right? It's about, you know, the level of experience that festival aims to put on, and really about the connections that you make once you're inside the festival, more so than, you know, how many people show up or what celebrities may have attended.
So when you first got into this, did you kind of look at, I mean, you got into this kind of during the transition period from, or the new period when it started entering the, we'll say the American festival economy. And I was curious if the European, if you planned on, you know, copying things from the European festival way of doing things, or if you wanted to pave your own path or.
Well, yeah, I mean, I started promoting some dance music events while I was still in college. This was, you know, between 2010 and 2011. And, you know, that's kind of where I developed my passion for electronic music. And simultaneous to that was really the festival boom in America, along with, you know, the legitimacy or the rise of dance music. You know, I remember when I was booking certain artists like the Chainsmokers, for example. I booked at One Spring Fling, and I think Brandon actually may have been there, and I paid him about $1,000, and you know, now they'll go off and probably headline Coachella next year and make $500,000 for an hour. So the times have certainly changed, and it's been a good thing. And I've had, or I'm fortunate to have had, many different perspectives within the industry. And back to your question about the European brands, you know, I worked for Tomorrowland for just over 3 years, and Tomorrowland is, I guess some people coined it the world's most popular music festival, which sells out each year in Belgium. And I helped bring their brand Tomorrow World to America. So I think, you know, we certainly brought a lot of the DNA of what makes a successful festival in Europe. But at the same time, what I think, you know, I learned to be most important is adapting that DNA to the local market, because you don't want to be viewed as outsiders, right? You want to take your knowledge and then also gain more about what is best for the market. And certain things that they do in Europe don't necessarily translate to America. Well, many, many of them do, such as, you know, more immersive and experiential main stages, and really creating these enormous sets and decor and interactive storytelling elements and themes and all of these great things, which were a little bit more prevalent in Europe before they were in America. But, you know, it was funny. I was in the VIP of Tomorrowland, and I see waiters almost in white suits, and they're passing around champagne, and you're eating hors d'oeuvres. And, you know, I don't think that kind of VIP culture works so well in America. In America, you know, you're looking for an open bar and some nice porta potties, and you're happy.
Heavy binging. It's just a right. Whole different level.
So it's just... And I think that's actually a great example of, you know, the differences in culture, and not everything Definitely. That works in one market works in another.
Heavy excess for America. Absolutely. Give us as much as you can, as cheap as you can. Let's shove it down our throats.
This is quantity over quality all day.
Yeah. And, yeah, it just, it really depends. And, you know, a lot of times you also don't know until you test things out. I learned that a lot about. When I was working on the Tomorrow World brand, you know, we thought it would kind of instantly sell out when we brought the brand in the first year. And it took some time for the brand to get recognition in America and grow. And a lot of that is through trial and error. And, you know, it's easy in retrospect to say, oh, I would have, you know, done things differently. But, you know, I think trial and error is the most important way of finding out what works and what doesn't.
Now, I've known you since college. I met you when I visited Zach the first time. And, you know, after getting to know you, connecting with you, becoming real close friends with you, and, you know, seeing you on your growth, you know, in that electronic music scene, the industry, I was always wondering how long has been electronic music been a factor in your life? You know, was it just since that time when, you know, 2008, 2009. I mean, that would say the time I got to went to my first event, our first rave,
yeah,
first party.
I'd say primarily, you know, I wasn't exposed to a lot of electronic music prior to college. And I think, again, that's, you know, due to the rise of electronic music. But when we were first getting into it, I think, you know, I guess to take a step back, I was really just not that into music growing up. You know, I was big into sports. I played football for most of my life. And, you know, music just wasn't an interest of mine. But then when I discovered electronic music when I was in college, all of a sudden, I kind of felt like I discovered a new world in that sense. So that's really when I would say that passion started. But I think it's also, it's more than the music. You know, I also love the festival culture. And I think for some people, those two go hand in hand. But there are plenty of festival fans that actually, you know, aren't music lovers in the same, or most festival fans are music lovers, but maybe they're not as into, you know, researching certain artists and listening to music all the time because they love festival culture, while there are plenty of people that absolutely love music, don't necessarily love festivals. Whereas, you know, because I really enjoyed both, I think that's really why I ended up pursuing a career in music and festivals.
Do you find a difficulty in catering to the different types of people that are attending music festivals that are similar to you just described?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's so many different types of festivals now. I think within the last 5 years, there are probably several hundred new festivals that have popped up in America. And I think we're also seeing the rise of the niche festival. And people don't, like I was saying earlier, don't necessarily want to just go to the biggest one. Want one that caters to their needs. What, maybe that's a certain type of freak camping shows. Festival.
Freak shows, psychopaths, Texas chainsaw murderers, I mean, giraffes.
Exactly. And now I think you could find a festival for literally anything. And that's not just electronic music, right? I mean, festivals in general, I think the ideology of festivals, I think food festivals have taken on a brand new light. I mean,
correct.
I don't know if you guys are familiar, for example, with Smorgasburg in New York, which has become, you know, what an unbelievable cultural phenomenon that has become. And we actually did a partnership with one of them on our festivals and brought a food fair within a festival. But I think the whole, like I was saying, the ideology of the festival has become more prevalent. And I think actually that dates back to kind of the rise of the amphitheater. And, you know, in the 70s and 80s, there was a huge shift in live entertainment towards amphitheaters where people saw mostly rock bands in that type of format. And then, you know, with that, arenas and everyone's seated experiences. And the festival is really the best way for a millennial to experience any sort of a concert, in the sense that they don't want to be confined in a seat, right? They want to be out there.
Not at all.
Interacting with people. They want as many options as possible. They do not want to be, you know, just seated, secluded in an isolated manner. They want to be social, or for that matter, hyper-social, and, you know, having an experience on their seat. And I think that's actually a huge contributor to the rise of the festival scene.
You know, my dad and I had that debate today about millennials wanting too many things, right? They want options. So,
well, it's like the overstimulation of everything around us, like, even plays into this. Joe or any festival producer or guy putting one together, they have to take all that in. I need to keep these guys stimulated at every turn, every crack of their head. They got to be, oh, something over here, something, smell, taste, yeah. light.
It is too much, like you said before, it gets to be excess, and it, sometimes it's overload. But some people say that that's what makes the difference in a festival. You know, when I was working for Tomorrowland, you know, its founders cared so much about every detail that we were making, you know, custom ice cubes with the brand and spending it, and, you know, really a ridiculous amount of money on that. But at the same time, that's also why I respect and love that brand so much. Because it's in the little details, and, you know, they wanted everything to be perfect. But, you know, if the goal is increasing the fan experience, then those details really do matter. And that's what separates a lot of these Class A festivals from the rest of them. And that's how they become so popular, right? Because maybe if Tomorrowland wasn't doing the customized cubes, it wouldn't be where they are today. And obviously that's not true, but that's just kind of a microcosm of what they do, and it's all of the factors of what they do that make it so special.
Mm-hmm. Taking those risks, taking those chances, just, and then getting to the point where you can take those risks and can take those chances, you know, to make, what, penis ice cubes and just passing them out to people, or, you know,
big H's for Hardwell or a big bird sign for Tiesto.
I find the economic implications of what you were describing kind of very fascinating because in your opinion, is a lot of this, it's grandiloquent almost. Do you think it's sustainable, some of the excess that's being spent?
Well, I think now in the last 2 to 3 years especially, we're seeing the market even out a little bit. We're seeing some of the bigger players in the space deteriorate. And I was speaking specifically about electronic in that respect. And also, you know, while I was mentioning there's the rise of the niche festival, also the market's just correcting itself. And the big festivals, the ones that have been there through the test of time, the Lollapaloozas, the Coachellas that are, you know, 10, 15 years in the making, those will be the ones that will continue to thrive. And the independent promoter will, you know, continue to have an uphill battle versus some of these behemoths, and one of them being, you know, where I work at Live Nation. And when you have that sort of vertical integration with all of your properties, it sets you up to succeed and puts you in a much better place than some of these mid-sized festivals that still potentially remain independent.
Mm-hmm. And before Live Nation, you were with Tomorrow World, Tomorrowland, or Tomorrowland, and you were producing and you were launching Tomorrow World itself, correct?
Yeah, so I was with SFX Entertainment. SFX was the owner of Tomorrow World, so I was really focused on the one event, Tomorrow World, for my whole tenure there at SFX, and I helped launch the brand in America, was the marketing director, as well as the talent director in my final year on the project, which was a lot of fun getting involved on the talent side of things.
So you put together, as far as, you know, prices, picking the DJs, selecting the DJs, and what, I mean, before you answer that question, like, what goes into that? Like, I mean, like, I remember before you were talking about just regional influences and trying to select and pick about how you design the festival. But in pertaining to the DJs, I know when someone is trying to go sign a DJ, after talking with you and another buddy who used to sign DJs or assign them to areas, you have to be worried about when they visited a place, how long can they go visit that place again. So what factors go into that?
Well, I think when it comes to talent booking, what's just most important is being aware of what's going on in the scene and staying current, which often, you know, I think it's harder as you get older and
definitely,
you want to surround, you want to surround yourself with the right people. And I think, you know, when you look at a festival, you look at it, it's like a painting or it's a piece of art. And, you know, you want to kind of paint the best picture possible. And a lot of it is, you know, your own independent thought. And for me, you know, I like to think that was in that scene for a long time and I'm using my gut intuition. That's really what you have to use a lot of the time. And there's also an element of seeing what other festivals are doing, right? What's trending that year? Style, you know, I could really only speak to electronic booking. So what new subgenres are popular at the moment? I remember back in 2014, for example, we had one of our headliners, Avicii, cancel his performance, and we ended up booking Kygo at his first American festival on the main stage. And everyone was questioning whether or not Tropical House would work on a main stage. And that was a big gamble, and it ended up paying off very well. So I think that's a good example. But you know, with these bigger festivals, it's really about crafting a lineup that has, you know, mass appeal. When you look at the Coachellas or Lollapaloozas, Bonnaroos, you know, those are all genres, and those can get super creative. But then within electronic music, you know, you want to appeal to all different types of fans, whether that's trance fans or progressive house fans, techno fans, and provide a great festival for all the different types of fans that will then really come together around electronic music.
And so are you looking to sometimes, like, put those stages together? So the festivals I've been to, there'll be a State of Trance, or maybe, like, a music label hosts an entire day.
Yeah, I think that I actually like to combine both within the festival, and I think that that provides, you know, the most interesting dynamic. And it's great that, you know, there's a certain area, for example, that is going to be the techno stage for, you know, 2 or 3 days of the festival. But what I always also like to do is kind of continue the education process for fans and not just have the main stage, for example, be progressive house or heavy bass the entire day and throw different types of genres there and kind of give fans a unique perspective each day and give them a reason to really explore the festival and all the different stages. And I think that actually makes for the most interesting experience rather than creating, you know, multiple stages where they're the same genre each day.
You and Oliver Helding got something in common, bringing underground to the main stage.
Absolutely. And you know what? Sometimes it doesn't work. But like I was saying before, you got to, you know, take risks with that and continue to try to push the envelope because, you know, there's a risk here with all of this that it becomes stale, right? And that's what both artists and event producers want to avoid.
It's great seeing like when Ultra, it was like 2013, 2014, them throwing Eric Prydz on the main stage and just seeing some of the people's faces when they deeper, darker Eric Prydz track comes on, like a SW4, and everybody's like,
right.
Am I supposed to dance this? Like, it hurts my ears. Right. It's like,
yeah, like that video from, what was it, the Terrace at Space, one of those techno DJs dropped the Prydz track, and the crowd was pretty confused as to what was going on, but I think that's a good thing. I think that there are too many labels in music, period, especially within dance music, and you know, music brings us together. I think it's the universal language, for that matter. And there's too much judgment and criticism and hate on, you know, people take music so seriously. Some people, it's like their race, and it becomes like a huge part of who they are, and they can get as heated or as defensive as a much, much more serious issue, which just, you know, obviously my mind is headed to the election. We're on the eve of the election right now, so... But it's just funny sometimes how heated people get within different genres of music.
No, I mean, I could definitely see that right there. It's I can even see myself sometimes just being, oh yeah, I'm not going to see that guy. You know, there's going to be those people there, and you can get caught up in it yourself.
Like, and you know, and we, I know Grant, me and you both were those people at one point. So, it's. Very ironic to be critical, and you know, no one should live their life that way, whether it's music or their day to day life.
I definitely think we've all had like elitist attitude in some sense. You think that what you listen to or what you have is the world, yeah, definitely. But I think having that realization afterwards that you know it all is part of the same family. Is almost like you learn from any kind of failure or any kind of mistake that you make in your life, and then you can come together afterwards and learn from it. And I think you can get that from learning from different genres as well, or the people you connect with in them.
Absolutely.
It's going more outside your comfort zones, especially. Like, okay, I'm going to this festival because that guy's there. He's performing. That's the guy I want to see. And there's a few guys like it. And you get caught up in saying, like, oh, I can't wait to see this guy again without saying, oh, I mean, until you get older, until you've been to a few things, like, who's this guy over here, you know? Or you become more familiar with different music sharing platforms. I think, you know, something like Pandora, SoundCloud, Spotify, who can, you know, plug you into people who are very similar and who you like, really helps broaden your horizons of the people you want to go see,
yeah,
who are similar to the style. Or even they might throw that screwball in there where you're like, oh, I'm going to go check this guy out. This guy was completely different, but next time I see him or he's at something I'm going to, I'm going to check him out.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Joe, what do you think? Okay, so this trend that I kind of paid attention to myself is you look at like 70s, 60s rock band, look at your parents and whatever music they listen to, and a lot of those musicians, they'll kind of play into their 60s or 70s, and you'll get your parents, they'll check out, they'll go see their favorite Dave Matthews show or Creedence, well, not
Creedence. The Dead.
Grateful Dead. Like, that's a perfect example. Or Lennon's son, to remember watching Lennon. Do you think that kind of when we are past our horizon for new music, that some of these, that there'll be festivals or something that is more maybe age appropriate as this group gets older?
I think, you know, the most popular music genre, or I guess, music is so generational, right? And whether that's very Elvis true. Getting in trouble for shaking his hips, or you know, the punk rock revolution, when mothers just didn't want to let their children out of the house to see rock bands, or you know, and then moving through the rap era with all of the danger and crime associated with those types of
very true
perform concerts, and really same with dance music. It's this outlet for various generations. And people often say, well, you know, are you going to be seeing Tiesto in your 60s? And probably not eighth. But I think that, you know, we're also in a time now, a fascinating time with, you know, digital streaming and VR and content and all of that. And I, at the same time, within for the music itself, I don't think we'll be seeing as many, you know, or I won't be attending DJ sets when I'm in my 50s and 60s as much. But I think that it's such a great time for electronic music when it's, or now that it's continuing to reinvent itself, creation of a lot of live elements. And I think that, you know, I could absolutely see myself going to electronic events throughout the rest of my life.
I'll be there with you, man.
I'm sure you will. I'm sure you both will.
Yeah, I definitely will be. I'll be going. Listen, we'll have to start our own festival if with you if there are some DJs that want to play late into their 60s and 70s.
We're talking to the right guy.
Yeah.
I'm sure there are. And you know what? There's still legends in the industry that are still doing it. I mean, I think Tiesto's hovering around 50. Carl Cox is over 50.
Yeah.
Sven Voth, these guys in the 50s, 60 years old. Giorgio Moroder, 70s, he's touring. And I think it's not going to be as much of a novelty anymore because it's really for these guys it's a lifestyle that they love. And you know, Tiesto's not touring 300 days a year just for the money. He's doing it because he loves it, and he's probably addicted to the lifestyle, though, to be honest. And that's why he continues to do it.
Now, I was curious to know what it took for you to get here. Just like, I know you were a former college athlete, like both Daniel and myself. And like you said, music really came on to you through college and starting up there. But how does one get into this music industry? You talk a bit about like promoting parties, starting there. And would you say that's really the first step and the first place where someone can really get into this industry? I know people like Pasquale Rotella was a big party promoter as well in California. And that's something that really jumped him into, you know, just throwing really awesome parties that favored, you know, the people that were attending, things that they could enjoy.
Well, I think there are a lot of different entry points into the industry. You know, for me, I mentioned briefly, I started doing some parties when I was in college, in large part due to the fact that I was a president of my fraternity and doing some social events. And then I kind of realized that it could potentially become a business. And oh, I thought I had a sneeze coming. Hold on.
I wish I made that Murillo show. I'll never live that down.
Well, you know, I think there were distinct points when I was in college and I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, and it wasn't really clear to me that music was a proper career path in that respect, especially at that time when, you know, a little bit before the festival explosion. And I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, and it was a pretty, you know, tough time. I was in college and I saw a lot of other friends getting great jobs, and you know, I was unsure as to what I wanted to do. It was a much more untraditional path, especially coming from, you know, the college that I was at. And when I graduated, I tried to follow that dream of actually producing my own festival. And I spent almost 8 months of my life after college working on that and taking a big risk in trying to produce this event. And, you know, it ended up not working out. And that was actually one of the best things that ever happened to me because I was probably a little... Now you could do that, but
that was the one in Philadelphia you were trying to put together. I think you're going to rent the baseball field out.
Yeah, I was going. You know, Philadelphia at the time was a for EDM festivals. There wasn't like a recurring annual Philadelphia festival, so you know,
the Budweiser festival was really the only thing that was coming through there.
Well, this was before the Budweiser festival.
Oh, really?
Yeah, this was before that. I was working to get permitting at a baseball field. I had it on 420 in the spring. I had a late night permit, so it was going to be a late night festival. And I wasn't able to do it because I didn't have kind of the connection, the reputation to get talent at that time, especially big talent. You know, it gets back to how hard it is to be an independent promoter at the time. And, you know, after that, after the event kind of wasn't able to pull it off, again, I really questioned, you know, if the music industry was right for me, what I should be doing as a next step. And I went through, you know, several months really kind of unemployed trying to figure out what the hell to do with myself. And those were some dark news for me personally. Until I got super aggressive in searching for a job and really trying to make as many connections, reaching out to as many people as possible, set up as many meetings. And I was just determined to find a job in entertainment, something that I actually felt passionate about, wanted to wake up every morning and get excited about, and I knew it had to be in entertainment. And, you know, I ended up emailing, I don't know, over my resume, trying to set up meetings, and all it takes is one It takes one to click back, right? And I had emailed, at the time, the COO of SFX, who happened to have been a UPenn alumni like myself. I put that in the subject line, wrote to him on LinkedIn. It was actually a copy and paste email that I sent to many, many, many different types of people, but one that I spent many hours working on. And, you know, it connected with him. I got an interview the next week, and, you know, from there, the rest is history. But, you know, you hear a lot about, yeah, you hear a lot about the successes of people in the industry. But I think I wouldn't have been able to get that job if I hadn't gone through some of those hard times. And that's what really motivated and propelled me to fight and, you know, get ultimately, at the time, that was a dream job for me. No doubt in my life. I mean, working for Tomorrowland, it really couldn't have been a better job for me at the time.
No, I think it's pretty cool that, you know, you hear a lot about how an artist struggled or at some point early in their career, like a Cascade or someone who fight through a down period where they were learning the industry, where they couldn't get booked. And it's cool to see the other side of the same industry, the business side, or the side that you have just as much passion for, just as much passion as the artist would. And to go through kind of the same thing is enlightening almost. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, like, you could almost look at it, if you take the parallel to the artist path, it's like, you know, when I got the job, I was almost like signed to a label in that respect, right? But I still had to really prove myself within the Tomorrowland organization. And that took a lot of time. And maybe I was putting out singles or remixes and I was getting noticed and things were progressing for me. But, you know, I started off as a marketing coordinator, worked my way up to marketing director, and then ended with marketing and talent director over the course of those 3 years, right? And I think, you know, one of the things I love about electronic music and being a young professional in the industry is that your opinion really matters. And I think that's so rare in business that somebody that's our age, at the time I was 23, 24, 25, being virtually one of the smartest people in the room, whether you're with senior executives, CEO, you know, presidents of other companies that I interacted with, because I was the millennial in the room. And that was kind of my in into a lot of these important
meetings. The millennial in a room. Let me write that one down. I need to give that one to my dad.
that's what really propelled me, right? But maybe if you're the millennial in the room in banking or, you know, insurance sales, nobody really gives a fuck about you, right? But when you're in the electronic music space and you represent the key demo there and you've been in the space, then your voice really matters. And that's what I think is so unique about working in the industry. And that allowed me to interact directly with the CEO of Fortune 500 companies. And, you know, that was definitely a blessing, and I learned a lot because of it.
So you have all this experience, you have, you know, the biggest voice in the room now, and you went through all these struggles, have all the experience.
Well, I wouldn't say I have all the experience, or that I'm the best voice in the room, because I'm learning every day. And, you know, I think that I'd be pretty naive just to think, just because I'm young and I've been an EDM fan, I'm the smartest.
Well, of course. I'm talking about in general of, like, being at these festivals. You've had this festival that you didn't succeed in. You failed at it in building it. And now you have all these under your belt now. You learned from this mistake and that mistake. But what else does it take? You know, I look at you as somebody who has, you know, chased their dream. It might have been another dream that they developed originally. But over time, organically, through human experience, through doing things that you enjoy doing, you found it. You chased after it. You talked to different times where you struggled to the point where it was like, oh man, it was so dark and so down on myself, comparing yourself to other people's journeys and experiences. But you made it here. But I mean, it's not all about those struggles and experiences. What is it that you do on a daily basis? Or what is it you do every day, even during those times, even now, that helps you gain and garner all this success?
I think it's all part of life's experience, and I think you know, change in people is a good thing, and I've definitely evolved over these years and learned a lot from every festival that I've produced. And I think, you know, maybe one thing that I've recently been paying much more attention to is really being you know, more calm, collected, and mindful when I'm at these events, working at these events, rather. And and not overreacting, because people can get so heated or so emotional in the moment, especially in live entertainment. You know, the best way to approach a potential issue on site is, you know, in a calm way. And I think that that's often really overlooked in the live event business.
Okay, I want to do a 360. I had some questions about kind of your take on maybe the state or the state that used to be like Vegas EDM, or maybe the press play era that we went through, and your opinion on something like that.
Don't they always just press play?
I think we're really, we'll have a better understanding of all this in just a couple of years, because I think we're certainly at the peak of Vegas, or kind of riding the coattails of it. I think when we were kids, it was about exclusivity and these smaller nightclubs and you know, unjustified bottle prices. And now it's
intimacy,
all about
like packed, tight,
exclusive.
Very New York.
And now we're seeing a huge trend where it's all about the DJ. And you drive down the Vegas Strip, and I mean, there's a 500 foot poster of Calvin Harris hanging on the side of MGM, and then you go to the next hotel,
Frederick?
And you know, there's Tiesto, and it's really unbelievable with the billboards and the banners. And Vegas, you know, the DJs have taken over the entire city, and it's become the party capital of the world.
It's like Space Miami on the beach on the weekend.
Are they profitable?
Yeah, well, ultimately, a lot of these clubs are owned by, or partially owned by, the casinos themselves. And the reason, really, for this club boom in Vegas is to drive foot traffic into the casino to then, you know, ultimately always come down to gambling. I think it is, in a sense, and it's become kind of a power struggle. You know, now there's one major player in the space, which is the Hakkasan Group, which owns Omnia, Hakkasan, and Jewel. Three of the, you know, probably six or seven biggest clubs in Vegas.
Yeah, I heard they make most of their money out in Macau and not actually Vegas, but I'm not too certain about that.
Yeah, you know, I haven't had too much work experience in the Vegas market in terms of the clubs, you know, but it also comes down to hospitality. And I think, you know, the Tao Group with Marquee and Tao, as well as Wynn Social and all their properties really showcase that. Yes, it's in large part about the DJs, but the reason that they've been able to stay in business so long is because of kind of the type of company that they are and the way that they treat
advantage.
Yeah.
They're just taking advantage. They're inflating everything, the numbers, the commodities. It's a mess.
So I do like, though, you know, compared to Europe, Vegas, the VIP and the GA kind of intermingle and mix a lot more, and it's not as much about exclusivity, whereas in Europe, a lot of the VIP table sections are completely roped off at different parts of the club. And, you know, yes, there's Vegas is dominated in large part by bottle service, but, you know, having people frequent the club with GA is equally important, and that ultimately also drives bar sales. So I think in Vegas they found a pretty nice hybrid with that compared to Europe.
When is your next festival? What's the next festival you're attending that you're not working? And when was the last one you've been to? Or are you just strictly working?
Well, see, in the last 2 weeks, I worked two festivals, Escape and EDC Orlando.
That's right, you went to Burning Man. That's right.
Prior to that, I worked Nocturnal for a day, and I was at Burning Man as a fan for a week, which was an incredible, really incredible experience. My first time doing that. Definitely hope and plan to be back in the desert. If not next year, then definitely in the near future.
What's impressive is I have two torn labrums. Right, I'm in a torn labrum sandwich. I got Daniel over here. Torn labrum. And now you have a torn labrum.
I
do have a torn labrum. I was at the doctor today, physical therapy all week, and I'm really, right now, trying to figure out if I need the surgery or not. And
I went through the whole barrage.
Yeah. It's a bit of a emotional roller coaster.
It's definitely not an injury that I would wish on anyone due to the, it's not the severity or pain, because it doesn't really have it. It's the length of time I'm recovering and the kind of the surrounding muscles that get affected by it. I'm 11 months out, and I opted out of surgery, even though it's suggested it. But I suggest you take a look into some of the other. They have stem cell therapy that works really well, and definitely exercise all your options.
Yeah, I definitely am not rushing to go under the knife. It's tough. I found out from my MRI today a lot of the effects of my shoulder were really predated back to my football career with different arthritis and different cysts in the shoulder. And then I re-injured it when I took a bad spill, actually, at Burning Man, unfortunately.
Oh.
So, gotta be careful at these festivals. Never know what can happen.
I live in the medic tent, my friend.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Every Sunday, you can find me in a medic tent. Do you still find time to work? I mean, so you were sports pre music festivals, pre music community. Do you still find time to work out?
Yeah, I try to stay as healthy as I can. This festival lifestyle doesn't always lend itself to the healthiest surroundings, but you know, ultimately it really comes down to your own mental will, and I wish mine was a little stronger. I think we all do, but I try to stay as fit as I can into kickboxing, yoga, do some circuit training. But
I'm gonna disagree, you know. Man, if you have some nice Organifi green juice powder with you at a music festival, past few music festivals I've been taking it with me, and to be honest,
that are some keto balls.
I'm not running out lasting everybody. I already did that.
Maybe, once you franchise your keto balls, Brandon, I'll I won't have any more festival injuries.
You have to eat those in a festival, Joe. They're life changing for a festival experience.
Yeah, and then I get back from these festivals. I'm tired. I could be hungover. I'm not eating well. I think it's important to kind of get right back into the rhythm of life after these festivals and not be
keeping
too
busy.
Nostalgic about it.
Keeping busy. Like planning trips to Europe for 3 weeks. That's what you had to do.
Yeah, I'd love to go to Europe. Let's do it.
Let's talk, dude. We'll talk after the show. Christmas. How you be in Morocco, no?
Yeah, maybe a little Europe popover. Yeah, a little Europe popover in January. We'll see what my schedule allows.
All right, so we've actually got some user questions. So we reached out to some of our listeners before, and we've got some user questions that I would like to ask you. So I'm not sure who this one's from, but how did you think Shaq playing at the festival would pan out?
It's funny. Shaq has become a buddy of mine in sorts. I hosted him at Tomorrow World 2014. And,
did you approve the name of his, DJ Diesel? Was that you as well?
Yeah, we discussed it. I was hosting him just as a client, the VIP kind of VIP customer, really. And he looked over to me and said, "This is the craziest shit I've ever seen." He goes, "I'm going to DJ this shit next year." And I thought he was completely fucking with me, and he was kidding. And then, he took my information, and we got to talking. And I had realized that he'd been DJing for over 20 years of his life, 30 years of his life.
Oh.
Back even when he was in high school and at LSU, DJing frat parties and vinyls, mostly hip-hop at the time. But, I think everyone knows, the big man loves to be the center of attention. And that's what the DJ is. So we, kept in contact, and he started, I actually almost made him audition, and I made him send me a few different sets to try to understand what kind of music he wanted to play, where he'd fit musically in the festival. And we ended up putting him on the trap stage, which is really an influence of, EDM and hip hop, which makes a lot of sense. And he absolutely fucking murdered it. He threw down. The stage was the most packed it had been kind of all week. We didn't put him on the main stage. We put him on one of our other secondary stages.
You have to send me the set if you still have it.
Yeah, I think, if you just Google Shaq Tomorrow World, you'll be able to find.
Yeah, SoundCloud should have it. You're right.
Yeah, you'll find some crazy videos. It was awesome working with him. He was super, super easy. Had a lot of kind of different PR media requests. Did a funny video with him and the Chainsmokers, actually. Should Google that one. Kind of before the Chainsmokers blew up. Getting back to them again. And
Syracuse alumni, dude. We're just everywhere.
Shaq's the fucking man.
Drew Taggart, Syracuse alum.
To our guests, we'll work to repost those after the episode.
Yeah, put them in the show notes.
Yeah.
Make sure you subscribe to the email, Joe.
So another question that we have from one of our guests: what's the best story you have about an artist?
The best story I have about an artist. Let's see. I think Shack One's pretty good.
It is. That might fit the bill.
I think that may be the most unique.
Tough question.
Okay.
Let's come back to that because none other really comes to mind.
Okay, I got a dark question. Do you feel, this is from Zenith, our guest Zenith. Do you feel that the evolution of our ears has caused the once great culture of EDM to burst into flames? From progressive house music to dubstep to big room to deep house, now ending with techno elitist, the scene was once about peace, love, and unity, and now he thinks that it doesn't stand for that anymore, and he's upset about it. Do you feel that way? We've touched on this a little bit, but...
I understand why he's upset, and I think a lot of people share that sentiment, but I would urge Zenith to be hopeful and really believe in the power of creativity. And I think that the computer and electronic music and all of that has really changed the entire landscape of not just electronic music, but music in general, and it's allowed for so much more creativity, new genres, and it continues to reinvent itself every day, right? I mean, just a few years ago, Tropical House was a genre, and then a year later, Kygo was the most streamed artist in the world on Spotify, right? And I think that that's an example of the modern times, and that should be, you know, people should be hopeful for that. And maybe if Zenith is talking a little bit more about, you know, festival culture and how it's changed a little bit because of that, yeah, it has. But, you know, like I was saying before, too, about, you know, of live music within dance music, I think is another new and exciting trend. And, you know, I don't think it's burst into flames. I think that, you know, I think we're on fire.
It seems like you just made an entire pitch to a Trump supporter right there. Like, don't be down about the future. Be optimistic.
Very true.
Don't put walls up.
Yeah, don't put walls up. Break walls. Break bridges. No, build bridges.
Very that's the most positive outlook we've heard all
day. There
you
go. Yeah. What else we got?
Okay, so this question that I have for you is, do you see, or is there any technological advancements or that you know of that are going to be improving maybe the festivals? You know, technology's right. Exponential growth. We have AI is on the forefront, and I'm wondering if there's anything that's going to be putting music festivals more on the map than they already are.
Well, I think ultimately it's going to come down to this whole VR movement, and nobody knows how big it's going to be or what a bust it'll be. I think the bigger opportunity than how the festival itself is going to change, and listen, production will continue to be improved, and the experiences will be heightened, and there'll be all sorts of new projection mapping and all that great stuff. But I think the bigger question is, how will your at-home viewing experience change? And, you know, in the last few years, we've gone through, you know, the popularity, the rise of live streaming. And now, I mean, I can't even go on Facebook for a minute without seeing a live stream of something. And now there's a personal live streaming.
Especially in the Ibiza season. Every second.
You know, and I think, actually, in my opinion, it's getting a little bit old, right? So how is that going to reinvent itself? And will VR be the game changer that some people think it will be? Are you going to be sitting there in your living room, you know, watching a Bruce Springsteen concert and paying money for that through your goggles? You know, having an independent experience? I'm not sure.
I think it's augmentation of reality and interacting with the people there and having a say or pull on what they're doing. Maybe not the performers, but maybe the people in the crowd.
A lot of it's going to come down to also the evolution of the TV.
Yeah.
Because I think that the TV has kind of so far stood the test of time, and eventually those TVs will be our entire walls, and you'll be able to sit in the front row. And you know,
how immersive is the question, right? Am I going to feel like I'm you know, sharing candy with the person next to me?
I'm going to be Bruce Springsteen's headband.
Listen, nothing is going to replace the personal experience of the festival.
I can attest to that.
Yeah, so ultimately, yes, you know, the importance of at-home streaming and experiences will rise, but I think the festivals will never go away just because people are streaming from their homes.
I actually have an idea for you. You know, it might be a little backwards, but Braille discos. Drop the silent discos, go Braille discos. Really test the senses.
Well, I was meeting with one company the other week, actually. Really amazing company that is developing technology, and I sampled it out in the office, and they wrapped my body in this. It was originally invented to help deaf people experience music and send vibrations through their body. And, you know, you could really identify certain songs even by the beats through your body. Now, you know, they're also trying to develop this just for festival goers in general to have a, you know, more immersive, quote-unquote, bass-heavy experience. So, you know, there's also that and all those elements. So the Braille Disco is not far off,
right? Yeah, unique content. I guess that's what you're providing right there. That sounds like a cool experience.
Absolutely, but then it gets back to, is that a cool one-time experience, or is that something that's going to last?
Well, I guess if there's considerable new experiences on a consistent basis, then maybe that provides an answer to both questions. We have a section that we'd like to engage in called rapid fire questions.
Okay.
Quick, short answers are as short as you can make them. So, first one. One last song you could listen to.
Oof, that's kind of tough. I guess it would have to be like a Prince song, just for old time's sake. Mm. Like an Everyday or one of those.
Mm. Favorite genre besides EDM?
Is EDM a genre?
Ooh, good.
Stump me.
Did stump me too.
I don't know. I like some of that. I try to listen to some of that old Woodstock rock band, but kind of like I said before, you know what? I really love electronic music, and I don't much about other genres, to be honest.
Hmm. All right. Berlin.
Berlin or Ibiza?
Oof. Choosing between children. No, I'm kidding. I wish I was able to experience both of them more. I've only been to each one of them one time. But it's kind of like, you know, winter and summer, they're just different. They're just different. I guess summer's better. But Berlin's fucking awesome, too.
Miami or New York City?
That's too tough, because I Miami's a vacation, New York's where I'm from and live, so I mean,
oh, I didn't ask if it was tough.
Alright, I mean, listen, I'm New York.
Alright. Plur or non-plur?
Plur. Life's all about plur. Plur is, if the world adopted plur, it'd be a much better place.
Cascade Fire or Ice?
At the time it came out, Fire is the EDM one?
Yes.
At the time it came out, Fire, now Ice.
Hmm. And last one, if you could see one DJ anywhere, any venue, who would it be and where would it be and why?
Oh, man. You should have given me that one in advance to prepare something, Brandon.
Well, I know your 2012 answer, but Prids at Cafe Mamba, but I don't want to steal that one.
Yeah.
If there's a time machine, take us back.
Yeah, I mean, I'd go back to some of those early, like, you know, times when we were younger, like raving, and I don't know, we used to love all that Swedish House Mafia stuff. That's probably when we were having the most fun, when we were seeing like Avicii with only a few hundred people and just raving our asses off, because I think that we don't get to experience those types of events as much anymore.
Well, hey, if you think you're missing out, Joe, give me a call. I need to relive some of those moments, too. Make it happen.
Absolutely. I think we can work something out.
Awesome. What can you leave one positive, negative, one note on the future of electronic music in this scene? And is it a scene that you see yourself in for
forevermore?
Forevermore.
Just a note on life. Today's a gift. Live it out to the fullest, and that's the motto of electronic music, but more people should live a life that way.
Well said. Well put. All right, Joe. It's great having you on.
Thank you, Joe. We are much obliged.
Thank you, guys. It was a lot of fun.
All right. Have a...
I enjoyed being on the bus.
Thanks for coming for a ride. Be careful of giraffe necks on the way out.
Ooh. Okay, where do I can't find the exit. Where do I go?
Exactly. That's what happens when you get on the bus.
I'll get the door. Yeah. 1 second. Drop your change, sir, please.
Oh, thank you.
All right. Have a good day.
Thanks. Bye.
Hey, guys. Thanks again for tuning into this podcast. Any of you have any more questions or would like to connect with Joe, you can find him on Instagram at Joey Silbs, J-O-E-Y
SILBZ. Don't forget to check out gophercase.com. Use promo code ONTHEBUS. That's all lowercase, three words. Make sure you check out OrganifiShop.com for your Organifi green juice blends. Use promo code BUSDRIVER, all caps, one word, to get 15% discount on your order. And then you'll see links to our Amazon portal on our Facebook page. Please do all your Amazon shopping through there. It goes to support this podcast. And if you want to support it the old-fashioned way, write a review, subscribe, or even share this podcast with friends, family, who you think might be entertained or find our conversations fascinating. And one more thing, for those of you who sent us questions, thank you so much. For those of you who didn't get a chance to and want to next time, please follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter at On The Bus Podcast. And make sure you're getting notified about upcoming shows so you can send us those questions. And until next time, the bus driver's out.
This is the moment for those who...